Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is Thursday, February 18th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, going where corporate media dare not go with George Noory, the host of Coast to Coast, the most popular nighttime radio talk show in America, and first, Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine. Our theme this evening in Money and Markets is Price Matters. For 2 years now, we've seen cost of capital allocated on politics. Some are getting capital for free. Others can't get it, period. It's not being allocated on price based on performance. And suddenly something happened today that reminded everybody price still matters. The Fed surprised the market. It raised the discount rate by 0.25%. Now, to put that in perspective, price matters, but the differential between those getting it for almost free and those who are paying a full price is still pretty wide. So now Wall Street and banks can borrow 0.75% from the guys who print money, while Main Street's still borrowing from 14 to 36% plus. Zero Hedge in the blogosphere declared the dollar carry trade over, and Goldman Sachs responded by saying the Fed's move did not indicate increased prospects for higher interest rates. That's really not the case, and in fact, Zero Hedge is right. The dollar carry trade, if it's not over, will be probably soon, which means people borrowing money for free and then turning around and reinvesting it at a spread to get the kind of profits that we've seen in Wall Street. In the meantime, Matt Taibbi came out with a new article in Rolling Stone called Wall Street's Bailout Hustle, and he made it much easier for Americans who are too busy to become expert in securities trading and financial fraud to understand the relationship between the Fed's almost free financing and Wall Street's latest round of outrageous profits and bonuses, explaining them in terms of two-bit street hustles and cons, which is very funny. We've got it up on the blog. I recommend it. The Fed described its discount rate increase as something that applied only to emergency rates. That's the first time in my recollection that I've seen the discount rate referred to as an emergency rate. Bill Gross from PIMCO chimed in supporting Goldman Sachs, saying that the Fed's move didn't indicate increased prospects for higher interest rates. Again, I disagree. But it was a reminder that price matters. I mean, it's a little bit, watching the market today was like, if you've ever seen a horse whose rider has them on a loose rein and then suddenly they pick up the rein and jerk their mouth. That's what happened to the market today because it was a bit of a surprise. And it reminds us that Bernanke's now been voted back in as the chairman. He's in a stronger position. Volcker's back. He's the king of raising interest rates, and he's back in the with much more influence in the White House over Treasury matters. We see an article earlier this week in the New York Times about the elders of Wall Street grumbling, a variety of different luminaries now retired or, you know, at the chairman status, really talking about the importance of letting firm fail. Volcker making his case, again, the big firm should be allowed to fail. It's almost like you're looking around Wall Street at all the excess capacity and saying, okay, who's going to be the scapegoat? Now, if interest rates rise this year and next, there are profound ramifications. We saw the Fed last year do pick up enough mortgages on their balance sheet to be the equivalent of being the mortgage market last year. They've indicated they're not going to do that this year. So the question is, who's going to finance the mortgage market? Well, that question's going to get more interesting with rising interest rates, and you almost wonder if attracting the capital to finance the mortgage markets wasn't part of the Fed's thinking. But we're coming into option arm resets, which means we have tremendous amounts of both residential and commercial mortgages that have to roll over this year and next, and this means higher interest rates for them. It also means the cost of financing the government deficit is going to rise. And when you're watching the president cut muscle out of the budget, we saw the NASA and the space program get cut dramatically in this new budget. When you see those kind of cuts, and you realize all that money is going basically to pay debt or interest on the government debt, you see the real pain coming. Now, there's sovereign debt concerns all around the world. Clearly, if you look at the fundamental economics of America, we in our state should be the number one concern. At the same time, again, as the controller of the reserve currency with the most powerful military in the world and a great deal of debt now around the world denominated in dollar, we're the premier leader of fraudulent inducement, and that means that position gives us a lot of control and power to drain a great deal more globally, including if we raise interest rates, which only raises and makes the dollar more powerful. Anyway, very important, we've talked about it before, is the Treasury at Christmas time committed to fund Fannie and Freddie's net deficit, which means they're now free to raise interest rates all day long because Freddie, Fannie, and FHA and Ginnie Mae's losses, so all the guaranteed federal residential mortgages, are really any losses coming from rising interest rates can now be monetized. The action in the gold price may tell a story. We saw in January a 10% plus drop off the high in late 2009. The price has been bouncing back. Suddenly, earlier this week, we got our old, the old canard IMF gold sales come out trying to trounce the market. Market dropped, it's then bounced back again today. It was almost a signal of inflation is really here, particularly if you look at the tremendous demand in the physical market. They're driving down the paper market, but it's only inspiring more physical demand from everything we see from the dealers and the volumes at the U.S. Mint. And so you almost wonder if the gold price isn't part of what's pushing the Fed to raise discount rates. Now, what we're seeing in the financial press is very strong reports of a stronger economy. Wall Street Journal today reports factories are gearing up, et cetera. That's not what I'm seeing on the ground, and that's not what's getting reported in from the ground. I did a little tour of the retail in Bolivar, Tennessee. Bolivar is our county seat here in Hardeman. Movie gallery was shutting down, selling big signs selling saying they're going to sell their equipment and furniture. I took a little tour around Walmart. It looked to me, my estimation was there's an order out for a 20 to 25% cut, inventory cut, across the board. Reports all over the place that people are running out of savings and money, more layoffs, and with it more frustration. And it's not just frustration on Main Street. We've seen Senator Evan Bayh announces he's quitting, even though he has a very strong seat and is expected to be able to hold it. That's a week after Congressman Kennedy quits, again, despite hometown support, expected to win his next election. But just frustration with trying to get anything done in the machinery, and probably between the lines, enormous frustration with the corruption. The greatest story today of frustration is Joe Stack, a software engineer in Austin, Texas, posted a letter on his website, then set fire to his home, got in a plane and flew it into a federal office building that houses the IRS. Now, it's interesting, one of our last Larry reports has been on mind control. Talk on the Internet today, question, was this a mind control operation? Don't know. It's too early to tell. We may be able to tell, seeing what comes out of it, but we may never know. There have been numerous forecasts of anger as a result of taxes and regulation in and around taxes. So this very well could be a sincere action, and I'm sure it's far from the first we're going to see. I've spoken about it before, but I'll mention it again. There's a wonderful book by a guy named Joel Dyer, investigative reporter, called Harvest of Rage, and it tells the story of the fraudulent inducement of farmers in the late 70s with debt and encouragement by USDA and agricultural policy to borrow lots of money, and so presumably it was going to be paid back because of subsidies flowing to the farmers. And sure enough, the federal government cut subsidies and dramatically raises interest rates. That was Volcker in the early 80s. And as that happened, it defaulted or seriously harmed tremendous amounts of small farmers, and in come the FBI and IRS enforcement to really add another major body blow. And it tells the story of the frustration and rage that came out of a community of really hardworking, responsible people. And if you read Joe Stack's letter that he posted on his website, it sounds very much like the similar things that they were grappling with. And I mention this because it is not unlike what I dealt with during my litigation with the federal government. I found myself in a pincer movement between the IRS, FBI, and 18 audits and investigations. And it's a situation that's very frustrating. It's full of double binds, just really horrible unfairness. And I wrote a post about it on the blog, which I recommend to you, and it's called Let Not the Sun Go Down on Your Anger. You can do a search for it on the blog and pick it up. And the story of Joe Stack, whatever the truth is a reminder of the importance of not letting your anger cut off your sources of imagination. And it's another reason I'm really glad we're going to be talking with George Norrie and talking about his book, Journey to the Light, because he has, it's an invaluable book to understand that there, you know, that there is another way no matter what's going on in the material world, and you don't have to let yourself get cornered by this game. Okay, states, we're watching more and more states pass legislation on the House side of the House, not the Senate. Georgia, a new currency law was introduced by into the House of Representatives, trying to resurrect gold and silver as a currency. Really out there, Virginia House passed a law, again, not passed in the Senate or signed by the governor, saying companies may not require implants of employees within the within Virginia. And we mentioned last week, New Mexico House passed 65-0 a law demanding that all state deposits be kept in New Mexico banks and credit unions. So, again, not passing the Senate's, not getting signed by the governors, but these are interesting. They're token efforts, but they're interesting token efforts, and it's going to be very interesting to see this year as the state governments grapple with their budget issues and the mandates from the federal government that they certainly now cannot afford. Will any of these things go anywhere? A very interesting new poll from Rasmussen in that vein. It says 43% say local government better than the feds. 43% of U.S. voters rate the performance of their local government as tops compared to its counterparts on the state and federal level. 60% of the political class, that's sort of the elite, rank the federal government as the better of the three. So, while nearly half of mainstream voters prefer the work of local government. Interestingly enough, these findings help explain why 59% of likely voters, that's people who turn out, say states should have the right to opt out of federal government programs. Now, that's a very high number. Even more, 63% think states should have the right to opt out of federally mandated programs if the federal government doesn't help pay for them. If we watch that number go up to 70 to 80%, which it might this year or next, you're going to see very significant change. One other thing quickly, 53% of male voters view local government is better than state and federal governments compared to only 34% of female voters. Women are twice as likely as men to be undecided on the question. So we really need the women to jump in here. Very interesting poll. Another study this week out from the Pew Foundation saying that the American pension funds are over $1 trillion short, and pointing out the risk of the tension within state and local government budgets over the need to fund the deficit. What they don't mention is they don't ask the question, where did the money go? Again, as we've talked before, tremendous amounts of money flowing out the back door of, you know, with all sorts of gains in the pension fund. Before you put more money in the hole, you've got to, or before you put more money in the bottle, you've got to plug the hole in the bottom. And everybody needs to keep asking the question, where did all the money go? I talked last week about trade wars and including the Toyota and Honda recalls. More information this week. Toyota apparently has a black budget, has a black box in some of their models that will record data about car conditions before a crash or an accident. Apparently, the government cannot access that data, whereas they can on U.S. cars. And there is pressure on Toyota as part of this recall effort again to give others and to give government access. In addition, Tesla Motors plane crash. It's up on the blog. Tesla Motors is a maker of an electric car. Right now they're fairly sporty and high-end, but they were expected to roll out a 2012 edition, much more affordable, and really take on the larger auto companies in competition at a time when General Motors, Ford, others are launching serious hybrids into the market. Tesla, in January 29th, filed a $100 million offering through Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And then this week, three executives killed in a plane crash. And I just noted at the bottom of the blog post, which I recommend to you, it's amazing between Tesla motor plane crashes, Toyota recalls, and Honda recalls what great market share luck General Motors is having since the government invested. Greece is still in the headlines, and the sovereign debt problems in Europe. It's still a little bit too early for the state and local budget wars, to grab the sovereign debt problem headlines. We see Jim Sinclair give a fabulous interview. It's up on the blog, literally talking about financial houses now destroying and taking over countries. The reality is it's a great interview, and I recommend it, but this is not new. If you read my financial coup d'etat article, Russia, Asia, Mexico, Latin America, throughout the 1990s, this was the problem, and this is a problem that's been growing and growing. It's finally reaching Europe and sort of the first world. And, of course, the question always is, is it coming our way? And I think the answer is clearly yes. One of the things we're seeing throughout Europe is something we've been talking about in China and also with American municipalities, and that is a lot of people very, very angry about the role of a few firms in the derivatives markets and how that's helped bankrupt now Italian municipalities and hiding debt on the Greek balance sheet. So expect the derivatives argument to get more visibility. But it's interesting, there is enormous and very interesting coalitions rising up and connecting against a few big banks, both here and in Europe, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens. It's all part of a process of shifting assets out of sovereign governments and switching them into banks and corporations for the benefit of a relatively small group of people who control investment in a very central way. It remains to be seen if this level of centralization can happen globally, but it's certainly evolving that way. And that's why it's so important that as we search for solutions, we network globally and locally, because, in fact, there are a lot of people now throughout Europe and throughout Asia who have an enormous commonality with us relative to what's been happening in the financial system. Our heroes this week are Bill Murphy and Chris Powell of GATA, my colleagues at GATA. Every time the war in the gold market got fierce and bounced up and down, they pounded out on their newswire incredible pieces explaining what was going on in the market, including a very fine and original piece we have up on the blog about the IMF gold sales tactics. And it's amazing to watch how smarter the general population has become, because you do have very honest people in the financial markets and the media, such as Bill and Chris, who are sick of the corruption and are really making all the inside baseball games understandable. Okay, quickly and ask Catherine two questions. If you had children today, would you vaccinate, partially vaccinate, no vaccinations? If you go back in our archive, we have some great shows on swine flu where we touch on vaccination and all vaccination. I would say probably no vaccinations or partial. I live in a farming community. There's obviously a reason for people to seek out tetanus vaccinations when and if appropriate. Also, depending on how you're traveling, there's travel where vaccinations are or can be required. And so, it's best to do them and take the precautions. Other than those, I would never have a child vaccinated unless I had a very strong recommendation from someone like my nutritionist, Dr. Thompson, and other people that I trust. But no vaccination would happen without a great deal of research, and it would always be the exception to the rule. Other question, do you think we will have another expanded war like Iran or Venezuela or South America somewhere, since we and NATO are circling Iran and China backs Iran, so that would mean war with them? Note this week that the UN nuclear watchdog notched the game up on Iran a little bit by saying that Iran is trying to develop a nuclear warhead. I continue to believe the concern with Iran is not so much a nuclear warhead as becoming energy independent. I think, yes, the chances of another war, and serious war, is 100%. Our economy is completely dependent on war and weapon sales, and whether it's because of the way the currency and the debt system work or because of the need for the Anglo-American alliance to balance the China and Russian economic powerhouses or our dependency on global organized crime and what it takes to manage that. If you sell $1 trillion a year of arms, you need them to blow up occasionally so you can sell more. So the reality is right now we have an economic and investment model which is dependent on war, and so the question is, at the root of the problem, is there a way to transform from the central banking warfare model? So with that, now we get to turn to the main of the event of the evening. I want to introduce George Norrie, who truly is a man who needs no introduction. But the great treat about me getting to introduce George is I get to say, before I do, from the west of the Rockies.
This is a treat. What a switch, huh?
I know. That's why I had to check to make sure you were in L.A. tonight.
I've got to put you on the air just to get back at you after this interview. How are you, Catherine?
Fine, George. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Wonderful.
Now, I want you to, you describe it in your books, but I want you to share with us tonight how it was that you became a radio talk show host.
I was in the media since I was 19 years old, something I always wanted to do, even though good old dad wanted me to be a dentist. And he was from the old country, and in those days, those guys would dictate to their sons what
right. They
wanted them to be. And we had a very old-fashioned upbringing. And, all my cousins were dentists. And when I was graduating from high school, he wanted me to go to the University of Detroit and to be a dentist. So I enrolled in a pre-dent class at the university. So for 2 years, my major was pre-dent, soon to go into full dentistry school. In those days, you could be a dentist in 6 years. Now it's like 8, 9, 10 years. So I did. And for the first 2 years, that's what I did. I took pre-dent classes, biology, science, chemistry. I loved them, but I didn't want to be a dentist, Catherine. And,
well, I will tell you that when you interview scientists on Coast to Coast, you seem to be very, very comfortable with science
Extremely.
And the research, and perhaps perhaps there was a reason for you to be pre-dent.
My upbringing, and we'll get into that in a second, I think really honed my skills for what I'm doing on Coast to Coast in all different facets, in all areas.
Uh-huh.
So for 2 years, I'm doing this pre-dent, and one day a friend of mine said, I need some help from you, George. And I said, what? He said, well, I'm going home to Cleveland. I work at a television station here in Detroit, but I'm going to Cleveland for Christmas, but they won't let me go unless I can find someone to fill in for 2 weeks. Would you do it? And I said, sure, Dave, I'll do it. And I worked at this TV station. I loved what I was doing. I was 19 years old. And I said, I'm going into broadcasting. So I went back and talked to my head of our department, and I said, I want to switch. I don't want to be in pre-dent anymore. I want to be in broadcasting. So he sat down with me. We went through all the broadcasting courses, speech, journalism, television production, radio production. He signed me up for all of them. And he said,
oh, you're kidding.
He said, I'm not going to get you out now. You got 3 more weeks to go for the end of the semester, but you'll start next time. And I said, great. And he said, the good thing, George, all the classes you have taken, you needed to take them anyway. So, you needed to get the math out of the way and the chemistry and all that. He said, now you can just do broadcasting classes. You've put the cart before the horse, but it worked out for you. So I did. Now, this is where it gets funny. My father would always get, even from my college, my report card. He was paying the bill. He was getting the card. and he would look at it and critique it all the time. Well, after that semester of broadcasting, he got my report card. He called me in. He said, "Hey, George, there's a little mix-up here." And I said, "What's up, Dad?" And he said, "Well, I don't know who he is, but the guy who's taking these broadcasting courses is getting A's and everything, but I don't see your pre-dent courses here." So they sent me the wrong report card. And I said, "Dad, I don't want to upset you, but I switched my major." Catherine, he didn't talk to me for 2 weeks. Just refused to talk to me. He was so upset. One day he was watching the ABC television news in Detroit, the local station, and up popped my name at the end of the credits. In those days, on a Friday, they would run the credits for everybody who worked at that local station. And I was a production assistant. So somewhere thrown in the group, there was George Norrie's name. And he saw that go by. And he said, "Oh, my gosh, that's you.
He's a star."
Yeah. And I said, "Yeah, Dad, that's me." And he said, "That's pretty neat." And after that, he was okay with all this. And that's how my career started at 19. Now, I ended up being in television news as an executive and a producer. That's what I did. And I did that for years. And that took me to Minneapolis. It took me to St. Louis, where I almost went to New York for CBS, but decided I wanted to stay in the Midwest. And so there I was for years enjoying myself until one day the station was being sold and I was in my 40s. And I said, "You know what? It's time for a change, you know, because I'm at the mercy of all these new owners and it's just time to change. I've got a family. I've got 3 kids. And so I picked up a job as a corporate executive for a public relations firm in St. Louis, which is now one of the largest in the world, Fleischmann Hillard. And it honed my skills, and I did that for 3 years, bored out of my mind.
You got to see it from the other side.
But bored out of my mind. It just wasn't me. You know, when you're in news and you're going on fires and news conferences and council meetings and police departments, that's exciting. I just couldn't grasp public relations, which is a great job and a great career for somebody, but it wasn't for me. But I learned a lot. So I just started looking around, what was I going to do and for my life, and I dabbled in television production, and I, you know, I had some successes and some failures. Then at the age of about 46 years old, I'm watching a movie on VHS called Talk Radio, starring Eric Bogosian, and he was a talk show host. He was actually playing the role of a real talk show host whose name was Alan Berg, who was a talk show host in Denver who was killed. But I just loved the part. I loved what he was doing in talk radio. And I said, "You know what? I am going to reinvent myself. That's what I'm going to do." And at the age of 46 years old,
I just want to point out, you have a family with 3 kids. That's hard to do.
It is very hard to do. Very hard to do. So at the age of 46, I knocked on some doors in St. Louis. Keep in mind, I'd been out of the business for a while, and nobody wanted to hire a 46-year-old guy. And finally, one station in St. Louis, KMOX Radio, had a group of people defect and go to a different station. So they had like 5 or 6 openings, and the program director said, "George, I'm not going to hire you full-time, but I'm hiring you part-time. I want you to do news and talk, and I'll give you as many hours as I have to." Well, and he did, and I ended up working 30, 35 hours a week doing late-night talk and everything else. Art Bell in Coast to Coast was on a competing station, and I would get a chance to listen to Art on my way into work. And I was always interested in the supernatural and the paranormal. You know, we'll jump.
Now, was that the station that where the Ouija board happened?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
Eventually. And basically, I was at this other station for 1 year. The ownership of the station that had Coast to Coast called me up and said, "Look, we want to go local. We don't have a lot of money. And would you be willing to come aboard and do this show? And if it develops, you'll make more." And I was still working somewhat part-time, Catherine, at the other radio station trying to reinvent my wheel. And so I said, sure, I'll take it. So I went in and I became the midnight to 5 a.m. talk show host on KTRS. They took off coast to coast and dropped the program for me. Well, let me tell you something. The coast audience is very passionate, as you well know.
They are fierce.
So I go on the air. Who's this guy who's replaced coast to coast? Not filled in for Art, but literally replaced the show. The show was gone. And they came at me like crazy. Well, after a while, they softened up to me, and they warmed up to me. And I did that for about a year, year and a half. And then all of a sudden, Coast to Coast, which was on a different station in the market in St. Louis, I got a call from Alan Corbett, who was running Coast to Coast. And he said, hey, George, we've heard some great things about you. Many of the guests that I had on the air, Art had on the air. You know, I was interested in that genre. So, you know, we overlapped each other. But they had heard about me, and they said, you know what? We really want you to start doing some fill-in for us. Unbeknownst to me, Art was having some personal and physical problems. So I did one show back in
April. I have to say, it's a grueling job.
Grueling job.
This is a very physically demanding job.
It's intense.
Yeah.
It's 12 hours a day, no matter whether you're in St. Louis or L.A. or Pahrump, Nevada or the Philippines. It's intense.
Right.
And so I started filling in. This was my first show was April of 2001. And I did that for about 6 months. And then lo and behold, the station that was carrying Coast to Coast in St. Louis called up the network and complained and said, why do you have a guy filling in on Coast to Coast when he's not filling in? He's the number one talk show host at night in St. Louis, beating us in the ratings. And the network said, oh, does that bother you? And they went, yeah, it does. So they called me up. And they said, George, I'm sorry, but we can't use you anymore. Catherine, I was brokenhearted. I mean, I loved doing what I was doing. I was doing my local show. I was doing some coast-to-coast fill-in. I was getting some national exposure. I mean, it couldn't have been any better for me. And yet, it was all taken away. Well, so after about a year, my president of our local station, KTRS, called me in and said, we're moving you 9 to midnight. We're taking you off the 1 to 5 o'clock slot. And I said, why? And he said, well, I got good news for you. I said, what? He says, I want you to start filling in on Coast to Coast again. And I said, I said, you know I can't do it because we were competing with them. That's why they took me off. And he said, well, that's why you're on from 9 to 12 because I'm bringing the show back. And so what happened is I would do my local show, Central Time, from 9 p.m. to midnight, and then I would do Coast to Coast as a fill-in for Art from midnight to 5. And that started, well, it was once a week, and then it was twice a week, and then sometimes three times a week. Sometimes, Catherine, I would get a call at 10 minutes before midnight while I was still on the air doing my local show, and the network would say, Art can't go on tonight. And I would run down the hallway. My engineer was already hooked up with the network, and I would do Coast to Coast. Well, what I started doing every day was preparing not only my local show, but also Coast to Coast for that
day.
Just in case. Yeah. I would find out who the guest was. If it was Catherine Austin Fitz, I would research you, get it all ready, just in case. And if it didn't happen, it didn't happen. But it started to happen more and more and more. And then one day in September of 2002, I got a call from the network, and they said, we want to fly into St. Louis and talk to you. That's always good news, you know?
Right.
And in they came, and they said, look, we want to offer you Coast to Coast for a full-time job. Art's going to announce in October that he's retiring, and we want you to have this show.
And is that when you moved to L.A.?
Yeah, so I moved to L.A. in 2003, and then I moved back to St. Louis, and now we're at a point where I come and go whenever I want. And I spend a lot of time in St. Louis, some time in L.A. It's because of kids, but you know, I literally go wherever I can go where there's a broadcast studio.
Now, I have a theory, George, and this is as much from reading your books as from listening to Coast to Coast, and that is you love to learn.
Yes.
I just see you as being a person who's curious. You love to learn. You like people. And you're on a journey to kind of figure out what's real, you know, what is really going on. And it's a huge, you know, we live in a huge galaxy. There's a great deal to learn. And you're just on this journey. And we're all kind of, you're like the sensei or the teacher. And we're all kind of following you on your journey.
Absolutely.
Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And what has happened? Guests like you in Gerald Celente, in Ms. Shedlock, where I'm not an economic genius. I've learned listening to people like you or scientists in physics. And I think what has made the show successful is I have taken the same journey as the people who are listening to Coast to Coast. I go on the air. You know, in the beginning, I've got some critics out there, you know, because I have a I didn't know that attitude on the air. I have that golly gee. And yes, of course, I research and I study. But a lot of times, Catherine, I will ask a question that I know someone in my audience wants to listen to, wants to hear. I may know the answer, but
right.
The point is they probably don't.
Right.
And so a good talk show host is supposed to do a show for the person listening, not for themselves. And by taking that journey, I have learned, and I've learned a lot from my guests, and it's been a great ride for me.
Now, you have incredible producers. That's
yes.
One thing I'll say. You've been able to attract people who also love to learn and are, you know, they're just, I mean, they have metabolisms of hummingbirds. I don't know how they do it. How did you manage to do that as well?
Well, I was lucky. I inherited arts producers, Lisa Lyon, who's our executive producer now. When I came to L.A., the group that I'm working with had all been changing from other shows. They were basically going to be out of work. And by coming to L.A., I was able to save their jobs because they just basically moved right in. And it all worked perfectly. And, you know, I have an ongoing working relationship with Tom Danheiser, who you know.
Yeah.
And Tom is responsible for the production of the show when I'm on the air. And also he works with me in setting up these newscasts during the first hour, which is how we got to know you. And then Lisa's responsible for the overall look of the show and the main show guest, the one who lasts the 3 or 4 hours. And it's been a great mix. And then we've got some other people, Stephanie Smith, who's behind the scenes, who lives in Oregon out there and works with Lisa. And we've got engineers back in L.A. and the sales and marketing staff and affiliate relations in New York. And it's great guns.
One of the things that's amazing, because your audience is very fierce and very intelligent and very, you know, diverse and amazing, but one of the things that I experience across the board is there's a real, you know, you really listen to your listeners. I mean, literally, you open the lines. And one of the things that, because I've learned a lot from listening to Coast to Coast, but one of the things I've learned is from listening to all the different, you know, the audience. Because the audiences will really, you get a very different picture of America when you listen to Coast to Coast's audience. It's a very different picture.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's
and I'm
no
having
dumbing
a great time,
down.
And I'm having fun.
Now, I wanted to talk about your new book, Journey to the Light.
Yes.
And I believe it or not, I want to start with the George Norrie conspiracy theory, which is one of my favorite parts. Would you explain the George Norrie conspiracy theory?
The George Norrie conspiracy theory basically is there are no coincidences. Things happen for a reason. Who benefits? Who profits? There's a factor of luck, and there is a factor of chance. But by and large, things happen for a reason, no matter what. And I used to look at that with everything I do, and I surely look at it here at Coast to Coast. And, you know, it's kind of scary, Catherine, because once you begin to approach things with that angle, you begin to realize that there's a bigger picture here that you never saw before, that you
Right.
never would have realized, and it's a scary picture. of what's going on out there, whether it's the economic situation or the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan or just about anything that happens, pharmaceutical, the swine flu, anything that happens. When you begin to look at it from the perspective of, you know what, there are no coincidences, then you see the picture, and the picture is pretty darn scary.
Although, the thing I love about your book is when I was going through the litigation, and I really got to the point where no one could help me, I was on my own, and that's when you start to really connect in the ways that you're describing in Journey to Light. You know, you really start to connect to higher powers. And there was a moment when I realized, you know, death is not the worst thing that can happen. And as soon as I stopped being afraid of death, all these new connections and powers started to, you know, it just started to unfold.
Exactly. You know, see, and I'm not afraid of death. What I'm afraid of is not accomplishing what I want to accomplish in the short time that we're here. You know, when I was 20 years old, I'm 59 now, I'll be 60 in June of this year. When I was 20 years old, I just thought I could go on forever. And then I got to be 30, and I still have that attitude. But then 40, I started to wane a little bit. At 50, when my life really started to change, physically and, you know, financially and everything else, I began to say, you know what, I'm coming up to the moment here. And, you know, now I'm going to be 60. My clock's ticking. And, you know, you read stories of how so-and-so died at 57, so-and-so died at 62. I try to take care of myself, but I'm in that age bracket now. Mm-hmm. And my fear is I want to make sure my kids are protected and the people I care about and love. And once I know I've done that, the rest is gravy train for me, and I'm not going to retire from this program. We are going to be renegotiating another 5 years. I've got a contract right now that lasts until the end of 2012. The network and I would like to extend that to 2017. We're going to wait for the economics to get a little better because I think it'll help me personally. And we'll open that up sometime next year. But, you know, that'll take me out to 2017. And after that, at the age of 67, I'm going to go 3 days a week. You know, I want to go like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I'll take 60% of my income. Uh-huh. We'll bring in some toughie who wants to fill in for me and run with it as I did for Art. And then I'm going to just go until one day we come back from a commercial and they say, he's not with us anymore. You know, how I want to go.
You know, you may be back in another form. So tell us about In Journey to the Light, what you're teaching people about all sorts of things that can help them navigate and really overcome the challenges we're facing. And
absolutely. It's a double book. A Worker to the Light, of course, was the first one. Journey to the Light is the sequel, which includes many, many stories from Coast to Coast listeners who took what they learned from Worker in the Light and applied it to themselves. And it's a double-faceted story of books. But what I'm trying to teach people is that our life is not by chance. We were created by some being, some higher intelligence, and there's a reason we're here. This is not just to have a nice little coffee time and we die and that's it. We go on. Life exists. We just need to perfect ourselves. And what I'm trying, and Bill Burns has been trying to teach folks in Worker and in Journey, is that there is a way that you can tap into this. I call it the wireless internet, and by doing that, you know, you can challenge yourself to be positive on every aspect of your life. Look, we're human beings. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to get sick. People we care about are going to pass on and die, and it's going to be depressing. That's what life is all about. But during it all, the secret is, how do you pick yourself up? How do you rebound? how do you keep moving? And what we're trying to teach people in these works are how to tap into it, how to meditate, how to find your mantra, how to challenge yourself and get into this kind of state of positiveness, not negativity, and move forward with your life and make it the best you can and prepare yourself for that spiritual travel that you're going to do one day.
Right. There's enormous power. How do we connect into it and use it?
Absolutely.
And it's a huge shift in our way of thinking.
And I'm sure you've been in a room or a party with that person who is so negative, who has that cloud over their head, and you just want to run away from them. I feel sorry for those folks. You know, I go up to them. You know, if they empty a room, I'm the last guy standing there next to them, because those are the kinds of folks that I really want to change and help. There's a story in St. Louis that's not in the book. His name was Andy. He would go to the Ritz-Carlton, and I'd go there a lot. And we'd sit in the lobby bar, you know, on Saturday. And this is when I was dateless at the time. I don't have to worry about that anymore, right? But poor old Andy would clear out this room, clear it out. I mean, 50, 100 people would walk out. And he'd sit there. But he never knew it was him. And the bartender would look at me, and she'd roll her eyes. And, you know, he was cutting into her tips. You know, all these people would leave. And
now, you're saying this, George, as someone who, there's no one who's brought more transparency to all the evil on the planet than you and Coast to Coast.
Yeah, that's so,
so
true.
You're not saying don't look at reality and don't have a good map of reality. You're not saying avoid what's evil. You're saying don't give into it.
Don't give into it. And these people felt it, so they left. So I went up to him and I said, Andy, I want to talk to you for a second. I said, tell me about you. Tell me about your life. Tell me about your friends. And he said, well, I don't have friends. I said, well, why don't you have friends? He said, I don't know, George. He said, all my life, I thought I had friends, and, you know, they didn't want anything to do with me. My life sucks. And I said, there you go. I said, you have got a cloud over your head, and you won't get rid of it. And I said, and that is holding you down. And I said, I want you to try something. I want you to, you know, change the way you look, change your attitude, change your style, and start enjoying life. Buy somebody a drink once in a while. Don't just sit there in the corner. And I've got
beautiful
to tell you, Catherine, he cut his hair real, you know, real short, changed his clothes. He was a little more hip. He did that. He walked in one day and bought a couple of people a few drinks. They almost died of heart attacks. And you know, sure enough, that negativity around this guy changed dramatically to the point that you wouldn't know him if you knew him before. And that is magic, I think.
Oh, yeah. Now, one question from one of our audience. How do you handle disinformation? How do you see it coming, and what do you do with it when you're faced with it?
I think it's a lot of it has to do with experience, having insight into just what's happening and what's out there, not believing in something handed to you, not accepting the company line, questioning things. And I've done that all my life. And I think, again, part of intuitiveness is understanding this. And it's been very beneficial to me for a long time. So,
now, you know, the other thing I have to point out, and I don't think that we might be able to explain it, but Art and you have succeeded in building a radio show that, even though you're owned by a corporation, you have remarkable freedom.
Incredible freedom.
Remarkable.
You know, and I guess it's nice to be successful, because,
yep,
you know, they tend to leave successful people away.
You get the hits.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so you always ask me this question, and so I finally get to ask you, what do you think is going to happen in 2010?
Ooh.
And going forward? What's your crystal ball show?
I'm a little concerned about the Iranian situation. I just think there's something bigger there. And so I don't think Iran is out of the woods, and I don't think we are out of the woods there either. So that's something I want people to you know, tuck away that that could happen in 2010. I think the economy is going to go through a false feeling of success short term, and I think we're going to get clobbered sometime August, September, where the reality sets in on some of the problems. I think foreclosures will be higher. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but my guess is 2010 is still going to be a rocky financial year. So I think people should conserve, pay their bills, buy what they need, but don't go crazy. I've always liked
Hunker down.
Yeah, hunker down. Your theory of, you know, building that community and you know, making that grow, I think is very vital nowadays. And take care of the people you care about. Surround yourself over the next few years with those people that you trust and that you truly love. And
the people who've invested in people are it's been the most successful strategy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, build yourself a little island with the people you care about. Don't worry about the big picture because, you know, the reality is we all can't change the big picture, but we can change these islands around us. And if enough people do that, eventually it will change the big picture, but it's got to be done collectively.
Right. You can access the great conspiracy through the intimate. That's what your book describes.
Absolutely. There's no question
about it. So, George, describe your schedule and how we access you. We can buy your books. You work every night but Saturday night.
I work the first Sunday of every month. And then,
first Sunday of every month.
And then I'm on Monday through Friday during the week.
Monday through Friday.
I will work every holiday that comes on a work day. I get 3 vacation weeks. I take one. And then on working those holidays, the company insists on giving you comp time. So I will take one Friday a month off to compensate for that. But I learned a long time ago that there are a lot of people out there who don't have family, that this radio show is family. And
right.
So Christmas, Thanksgiving, I'm on the air Easter Sunday. That's important to them. And, you know, sure enough, if I'm going to be there and it's a scheduled day, I'm not running a tape, I'm coming on the air. And that's what we're doing. In terms of my day-to-day schedule, well, it's a good 12-hour-a-day schedule with lots of email checking and research and show prep and then future prep for other shows. And I'm starting to do more and more television. So,
are you doing speeches around the country?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I give speeches around the country, and I do affiliate relations trips as well. I just came back from the Conscious Life, which fortunately was in Los Angeles. But I've gone all over the place, Washington, Norfolk, Austin, Texas, Houston, wherever there are major events and they want me to speak.
And people can also the full archive is available at the website.
Past 3 years available.
Right.
If you're a StreamLink member, we're going to open that up to 4 or 5 years. It's a technical thing.
Oh, really?
And we have iPhone apps now. And StreamLink, I love it because that doesn't take away from your radio station, but it allows you to podcast and download. And you do these iPhone apps now, and now they're going to work on BlackBerry and all these other things. It's great. Technology is just absolutely amazing.
Well, George, you bring a lot of light into our lives.
Well, thank you, Catherine.
And we really appreciate it. Just 2 more minutes. Tell us about your audience. You know, the first time I was in Coast to Coast, somebody said to me, you know, the audience is pretty wacky. You're going to get a lot of wacky comments. And, George, I got over 1,000 emails from my first show.
Oh, it's huge.
I gave my email address, and they were the most intelligent, remarkable comments. I mean, it was 1,000 messages from highly intelligent, engaging people with tremendous feedback. It knocked me. It took me weeks to answer them all.
These listeners are extremely intelligent, on the ball. They are perceptive. They read. They study. They are intuitive. I mean, they have the tools necessary to help drive this country to the top. Whenever we talk with guests about people who don't know, we're not talking about the Coast audience. I mean, as they well know, We're talking about those that aren't listening to this program. I think those people who have migrated to this show are probably some of the smartest people on the planet.
Yes, they're very, very smart. And one of the things they appreciate is what they'll say is, you know, I don't agree with everything, but what I love is that George and Coast to Coast let me decide what I believe. They make everything available. They don't censor, and I'm free to decide.
Absolutely. I have found that there's one area where people who have their own philosophical views, and that's climate change. Man, if they believe it's man-made, there's nothing you can do to get them to think otherwise. I happen to believe the planet's in a cycle right now,
right,
and it happens. Not to say that we don't want to control pollution. And I think a lot of people with climate change who believe that mankind is doing it, I think they're confusing pollution with cycles of the earth. Nobody wants pollution on this planet. Heck, if I'm walking down the street and I see a piece of paper blowing by, I pick it up.
Right.
I throw it away. Nobody wants pollution. But
are they stuck because it's so hard to believe that they're the patsy?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. I think for them to have to admit that they may have been led astray, they may have been tricked, they may have been lied to, is pretty difficult for them to take. And it's probably easier for them, rather than admit it, to continue fighting for what they believe in. Hey, God love them for what they believe. I just don't want them to have to chastise me or you for what we believe.
Well, the reason I think this is important is I think cap and trade is going to make, you know, I've always said cap and trade would make derivatives look like something that Mother Teresa invented.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, if we could broaden the understanding and discussion with that group, I think it would be very positive.
I think so, too.
Okay, well, George, thank you so much for your, I know now you're going to get off and you're going to do many hours of a great show, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate having you on the Solari Report.
And the next time the phone rings, it's probably our producers asking for you. Thanks, Catherine.
And I will say yes. Thank you, George. Have a wonderful evening.
Take care.
Bye. Okay, coming up next, March 4th, we have From Permaculture to Profits with Eric Tonsmeyer. A wonderful permaculturalist. He's the author of Perennial Vegetables from Artichokes to Taro, A Gardener's Guide to Over 100 Delicious, Easy-to-Grow Edibles, and then co-author of an incredible book. It's one that I have in treasure, Edible Forest Gardens, Ecological Design and Practice for Temperate Climate Permaculture. We've gotten a lot of great questions about, you know, what are the businesses you can start in this environment, which make, you know, sort of sense in this world and make sense in, you know, sort of in a local area. And permaculture offers tremendous opportunities where we can organize sort of the permacultural ideas into really smart small businesses that create employment and products and services that really offer good, healthy food to a local economy. And Eric's done a wonderful job of prototyping and starting businesses and thinking that way. And I think is just the kind of person who can help us figure out how we might apply permaculture in a financially and economically smart way in our place. So I'm really looking forward to that. Our movie will be Killer at Large, a documentary. The subtitle is Why Obesity is America's Greatest Threat, a fantastic documentary made a few years ago. You can get it through Netflix, and there's a link with a trailer up on the blog. If you just do a search on the blog for Killer at Large, I strongly recommend it. Part of the reason I want to watch it and I want you to watch it is it really gives you an incredible understanding of the kind of food that's being fed to our children and how important it is to change the diet that children enjoy in this country. Then March 11th, Precious Metals Market Report. We have a lot to talk about. And our movie, again in the food vein, will be Super Size Me, Morgan Spurlock's incredible documentary about eating for 30 days at McDonald's. So until then, you're in our prayers. I'm so glad George explained his conspiracy theory because it's really in line with my feeling that it's important not to worry about whether or not there is a material world conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. So, ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. I'll be talking with you in the first week of March. Good evening.